My name is Michael Coates, and these conversations highlight the challenges, achievements, and societal issues within social housing. In this episode, we speak with the current chair of the G15 and the CEO of one of London's largest housing providers. We talk about how her parents escaped India as refugees, growing up with strong female role models, and how authenticity and diversity is key. We also speak about psychology, working within different cultures, and why her work now is so much more than a job. This podcast was created by Combat Pest Control in partnership with Metropolitan Thames Valley. Episode 6, Geeta Nanda. This is Breaking the Cycle. Born in Kent.
Yeah, born in Kent. It was where my parents landed, Gravesend. Not the most best of names, hey, to say where you were born.
Where did your mum and dad come from?
Well, they came over from Kenya and they moved to Kenya many years before, after they got married.
And that was, so India was turbulent in the 40s. Was it all off the back of that? There was a lot of migration from to Kenya.
Yeah, well, actually what happened is my mum was around 13 when the politician, 12, 13, and she, you know, lost everything. She's now in what is Pakistan, Hindu. I mean, it was a really traumatic time. She walked for miles and miles and miles, you know, taking water off dead bodies, because that's all you know, that's what happens when you have these massive partitions and events. And she ended up, the family ended up moving to Thailand because her brothers had set up some business in Thailand. So they moved over to Thailand. My dad's family, it's so interesting, actually. They were in a train coming across. The train got attacked. My grandmother had poured petrol over herself so that she would set herself on fire, because what would happen is they would be raped. So, you know, in anticipation of being raped and then killed, she sort of put petrol over herself. And then the Indian army came over the hill, and as the train had been stopped, saved them. So they were saved. And then, because they were originally from the same town, from the same village, there was an arranged marriage, and they got married. My mum moved back to India. There wasn't much work in India. They moved then to Kenya, and my dad was an English lecturer in Kenya, actually.
Before all that, just that, because there was well over a million people died in that when they were going from what's now Pakistan and backwards and forth. And did, we're jumping ahead a little bit, did your mum and dad speak a lot about that time?
Well, it's quite difficult. I mean, we want to talk about it. And my mum's, you know, she's a chatter, so she does talk about it, but she's very matter of fact, you know, she's very matter of fact about it. It was very traumatic at the time, and she talks about the impact it's had on her on food. Like, she's a real foodie and she hates waste. You can't leave anything on your plate, and it all goes back to being starving, you know, as you're sort of, you know, lost everything. And she talks about the house they had, and they had a horse, and, you know, they had to leave all of that behind. And many years later, she went back to see her house. She went with one of her friends who went through the same sort of experience, and the two of them just went off to Pakistan to see where she lived, and they let her into the house, and she saw her old house. So she had those memories of it as a child, and then going back, really. And she said it was really dirty and terrible, and all those memories she had were totally different when she went back to see it. But they had an arranged marriage. They lived in India, then they went to Kenya, and my dad was quite involved in politics, and my mum loved living in Kenya. She said it was great. It was really nice. She really enjoyed it.
Would they have been classed as refugees
when they went to Kenya?
Well, the full time.
Oh, yeah. They were refugees. And also, when they settled in Thailand, when my mum settled in Thailand, you couldn't, you know, for years, all the time, and all my relatives, I've got loads of relatives out there, a lot of them still had to keep going out the country and then coming back in the country, because the only way you could, you know, they didn't have a residence. They had a residency, but they didn't have a full right. So you had to keep going out the country and coming back in again. It was all very easy to do, but it still meant you weren't a citizen. You had residency, but you weren't a citizen. And for many years, I used to go out and then come back in again, and go out and come back in again. But yeah, she was a refugee, and then from Kenya, because my dad was involved in, you know, he could see what was happening in terms of the politics there, and so left before came to this country in 56. So it came before the big migration. Then helped other Indians, settled in Gravesend. A lot of Indians came via Gravesend, and he helped a lot of people come over from Kenya.
Was that a financial kind of situation?
Yeah, I think he wanted to come to the UK, wanted to work here. He was a traveller, always wanted to travel, was planning to move to Canada with all of us. And my mum said, I've got three girls now, I'm staying here, we're not travelling anymore. But he loved sort of travelling and living in different countries. But he also could see political change happening in Kenya. And I think he wanted to get out before what happened. Well, it was devastating, impact for a lot of Indians there.
Mm. Did he feel British?
I think he did, actually. I mean, I was only 9 when he died, so obviously I hear a lot of things secondhand. I can't really remember, but he was very proud of, what he managed to achieve in this country. And he suffered a lot of racism, as did we all. But he managed, when he came here, he couldn't get a job as an English lecturer because he was an Indian, and an Indian being an English lecturer wasn't going to work. So he retrained and became an engineer. And it's the wonderful stories of migrants and what they managed to achieve. You know, they don't think anything about what they have to do in order to provide for their family or get on. So he retrained, from English to maths, if you like, an engineer. And he did that for his family. He did that because he wanted stability for his family. I think it's a great story of what people could achieve. And then he really wanted to help other people. But he managed to build a really good life here for the short time, he was alive.
Do you remember when he died?
Yeah. Yeah. I was young, but he'd been in and out of hospital, had bowel cancer, very treatable now. But in those days, less, I suppose there wasn't the science that there is now. But it was a massive impact, obviously, because my mum hadn't worked. My grandparents lived with us. They'd come over from India and were living with us. They kind of went backwards and forwards from India to us. So, my mum was there with 3 children in a country where she didn't have her family. All her family were in Thailand. That was very difficult for her because she hadn't worked previously. She'd been caring for us as kids, caring for the grandparents. My granddad had been very sick and died, and she looked after him. She'd been looking after my dad as he was sick. So she was suddenly left, we had no money, and she had to go out and work, and she'd never done that before.
So it was you and 2 sisters?
Yeah.
Well, where are you in the...
I'm the little one.
Oh, yeah.
The youngest, yeah.
And were they settled? Did they... I'll rephrase that. After he died, did it bring you together? Did you feel like you were safe? Did you feel like you were supported as a family?
Yeah, I think all children have these different roles, don't they, in the family. And even though I was the youngest, I've always been the practical one, so I was changing the plugs and sorting out the things, and also sort of going to the bank with her to, from a very young age, trying to sort out all the paperwork and the loans and all the rest of it. And my middle sister is the sort of softer one, really. So she's very sort of emotional and comforting. And then my older sister, she'd just gone to university. So it was a big gap. So she was in university. So she was quite on her own up there at university. So that was very hard for her. But we were a very strong family. I shared a bedroom with my sister and my grandparents for many years, it wasn't much room. So, yeah, we're a close family. We're still very close.
And celebrations and things, everyone would be together?
Yeah.
How was the community then in Ruislip? Was it mixed? Was it, did Indian families gather together? How was kind of celebrations and things?
Yeah, well, Diwali's a big celebration for us, so we'd always have huge celebration. My grandmother, I mean, she was a big maternal figure in the community. And people would, you know, come and be very respectful of her and ask her advice. And, you know, so she was a very big figure. So we would have a lot of celebrations. But the thing was that it's difficult when you're, you know, my mum was the only one who was a single parent, really, in the community, because and so that restricted things a bit. I mean, we didn't, you couldn't go, people would have to come to us. We didn't have the ability really to go and see other people so much, otherwise it'd been huge long train journeys or this or that. So I think she was a bit isolated for a while. You know, lots of people obviously kept contact, but they have their own, you know, it's a different lifestyle. Really. Her lifestyle changed quite a bit. But she's an amazing figure who attracts people, from, as I say, from 18 to 100. They just all attracted to my mum. So she just invites everybody into her house. And she created and recreated her life at that time.
A simple question. Did your mum, at that time, did she speak English fluently?
Yeah, she did. She was brilliant because she spoke Thai. She's the first one out there. When the family went there, they would send her out. She was the youngest, and she would negotiate the vegetables and, you know, learn Thai. And they all got confidence from her, really. And then she spoke Swahili when she went to Kenya, and she loved languages. So when she came here, she was very keen to speak English. And also, it's very interesting because in those days, because my sister was born in Kenya, and in those days, in education, they'd say, don't talk to your child in two languages, just speak to them in English because they're getting confused. Because she could speak some Swahili and Punjabi, which is what we speak. So at school, she would say some other words, and then they said, no, you must speak to her in English, which is ridiculous, isn't it? So we, you know, my mum and my grandmother didn't speak English so much, but they did. They spoke to us in English because they said your first language has to be English, and that's what the education system used to say in those days.
The British colonial machine. So you was in a house surrounded by strong women.
Yeah, three generations of women. All women.
Yeah, but good role models, the way they conducted themselves and how they, I suppose, stepped up, really, because with finance and you know, the missing piece there with your dad. Did you feel like you were missing anything growing up?
It's funny because my mum's still in the same house, and I go there and I sort of think, God, how did we all fit in here? But it never felt overcrowded, you know. It didn't feel. I go into the bedroom where we had bunk beds and my double bed with my grandparents sleep, and one cupboard in the corner, and it's not very big at all. It's probably about 10 foot by 12 foot. But it never felt overcrowded because that's what you were used to. That's what you kind of. So no, it was a very warm family atmosphere.
And education at that time, so where you're northwest London.
Yeah.
Education at school, was that diverse? Was it?
No. So we, so where I went to school is very different now in the same area. But when I was there and went to school, so when I went to secondary school in Northwood, it was a grammar school, and then it turned comprehensive. So the comprehensive system came in when after my first year in school. And there was five of us who weren't white, and they put us in the same class together, which was great, actually, because, you know, we had quite a different experience. We were very strict upbringing, weren't allowed out. And we kind of stuck together a bit, and other friends as well, you know. But we were all slightly, you know, we had the quiet one, we had the Jewish one, we had the Indian one, we had the, you know, we were all slightly on the edge, really, of the kind of mainstream cool ones. We weren't the cool ones at all. But it was just not very diverse in those days. So, yeah, there was quite a lot of racism, and it was just the way people behaved then. You know, Paki was a word that was thrown around a lot, and people would laugh about, you know, if you had Indian food, and my grandmother would be wearing a salwar kameez, you know, traditional wear, and people would laugh at her. And when we moved into our first house, there was a petition in the street to not buy the house, and my dad actually couldn't get a house for a long time. So he got his boss, who was white, to go to the estate agent to say he was buying the house so that we could get it. And then there was a petition in the street against us. There were eggs thrown, and it was quite a
scary.
Quite a white area, yeah. And so it was different.
But what was it? I said scary then, but was it scary growing up with that threat? Do you remember?
You just get used to it. It's funny, you look back now and you think, and you know, you talk to the kids about it. My mum was always very matter of fact, and she said, oh, they just don't know what they're doing. And it wasn't, the scary time was when I was sort of probably a teenager and the skinheads were around, because they were quite scary and they would spit at you and gob at you and, you know, and that was more scary. Mm. But otherwise it was more language and putting you down, and you would then try and fit in, and you would do things to try and fit in. And so you'd have your home life, and then you'd have your school life and your life outside. So you would kind of be this split person who would be doing certain things at home and then, you know, acting in a different way outside of home.
But kids adapt to fit in, don't they?
Yeah, and yeah, definitely.
And avoid people, don't, especially children that don't like to be different normally, you know, generally speaking. University, was that a different experience?
I loved university. It was great because I moved away from home, and so it's total freedom. And it was, you know, I had quite a strict upbringing. So and I loved the freedom of university. And, you know, at school you kind of pass exams. It felt like you were just studying to pass exams, whereas at university you had freedom of thought and you were reading and you were, and I did psychology actually. So, I chose psychology because I thought, well, like all the we only did normal subjects in those days. It was geography and economics and art I did, but art history. But I just thought, it's like, oh, that sounds interesting. So I thought I'll do that, just something different to what I'd done. So I loved it. I absolutely loved university.
And there was the plan then to be go clinical or research? What was that?
Yeah, I wanted to, I thought about, they said to us, only one in three of you will do psychology when we went to one in four or something like that. You'll all end up doing different things. And I thought I wanted to do clinical psychology. I thought that's what I'd wanted to do. So I worked in a psychiatric hospital for a year.
After your degree?
Yeah, well, it kind of spanned my last year at uni and then off when I finished to see whether I liked it. Mm.
And you like it?
And I didn't. Yeah. It was in the middle of nowhere. There was one bus that went to this institution and one bus that went out again. And it was literally like the old movies you saw clanking beds. There was a sort of soundproofed white-walled room where they would lock people in. There was a woman there who was around, she was late 80s, 90, who had been put in the institution as a 16-year-old for having an illegitimate child and was really institutionalised. And it was just really horrible. I mean, it's now a housing scheme. Most of those old institutions have become housing schemes now as they close them down. But I worked in the day centre where I kind of moved from the wards into the day centre, and that was better. And there was art therapists and other therapists working with people. But it was quite a frightening environment, and I just thought, no, this isn't for me. I just yeah, not for me. I couldn't. The way people were treated was horrendous. It was just horrendous.
Growing up and then into that, have you grown up a compassionate person?
Yeah, yeah. I think I wanted to do something where I worked with people and something where I've, you know, felt I could give, you know, that I could grow and learn, but I definitely wanted to work in a people industry.
Mm. So out of the frying pan into the Wandsworth local authority bias.
Yeah.
What's your experience with local authority? What was that, the mid to late 80s, is that?
Yeah, and it was Wandsworth Council, and it was a graduate trainee scheme. And the idea was you worked in sort of different directorates. So I started in housing, then went into finance briefly. And I worked in the main office, in the main housing office in Wandsworth Council. And then I went worked down on the estates. And the main council office in the executive, chief executive in the housing directorate department was just really weird. It was really weird. I mean, there was a trolley that came along at 11 o'clock and everybody stopped and had their cup of tea and smoked their fags, and you could smoke in your office. If you had an office, you could smoke in the office. And but they were like page three new women on the pinned on the wall, and they were like racist materials about monkeys and black people, like on the walls. It was just, and there was, it was Masonic, and it was like, there was, it was just the weirdest place. When you went down on the estate, it was great. The estate offices, where lots of things happened, were really great, and really nice people, really caring, wanting to do a good job service. But in the head office, it was a very bureaucratic and very odd place at that time.
Mm. And one of at that time was, I suppose, working class. Is obviously now it's you know, it's very wealthy, but at that time it is.
Yeah, I worked down in Battersea, and Battersea was, you know, the Battersea estate, big estate down there. It was very working class, but it was just the beginnings of the right to buy, and selling off some of the sort of council homes, and you know, Wandsworth was changing.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, you know, the housing service and the people who worked in the housing teams were great, but it was the head office. It was a very weird place. The head.
Did you stay there long?
No. I really enjoyed my time working down on the local housing office. And then I went into the finance directorate, and I was doing a project which was really speeding up the right to buy sales. And it was just, there was a lot of selling off of homes to people who worked in the borough, who were wealthy. And I just, it just went against my principles around, you know, I kind of understood the right to buy in some ways, but the who were getting some of these houses all around Clapham Common, and some of the really lovely houses being sold off and wealthy, you know, that people who were buying them were pretty wealthy, and it just didn't, it kind of went against my values. So I then got a job, and it was just a year's contract doing housing research, actually.
Mm. So that was speaking out?
Yeah. So the report was called Speaking Out, and what they wanted to do is a different kind of report rather than research figures and facts. It was about speaking to people around their experiences of housing. And it was, I loved it. It was fantastic. It was interviewing people and then writing it up, and it was money that was left over from the GLC days, actually. So they were kind of sent, you know, organisations that were kind of getting money from that, the end of that. And I went and interviewed this woman. It really stayed with me a long time, and she lived in Maida Vale, and she was renting. She'd been renting, and she had 5 years to live. She had, you know, a terminal illness, and she wanted to be somewhere peaceful, and so she had this short lease. And there were these private lands with Rackman, and they basically had a hold of, they wanted to, if they could get people out of properties, the price of properties would go up. And what they did to her is they nailed the front door and the windows and cut her phone line. So she was stuck in the property, unable to get out. And that was their way of scaring her to give up her her short lease in order to get the property back. I mean, imagine how absolutely petrifying that would be.
Was this before you were speaking to her? Was this at the time?
No, she was telling me about that.
Oh,
right. It happened to her. And she was telling me about the tactics that had been used to try and get her out of the property. She was an incredibly strong woman and she did nearly give in. But she decided she was going to stay there. Nobody, you know, nobody was going to get her out her property. So they tried all sorts of things to intimidate her out. They managed to empty the whole, the rest of the house, but she stayed in her flat and she wouldn't go.
How old?
She must have been mid-50s.
Oh, right.
Mm.
And she was stalwart in her approach.
Mm.
What other... From that, because obviously that was a better version of this podcast. That, not this specific episode, but what other stories came out of that speaking out?
Well, there was this amazing group of Bengali women in Tower Hamlets, and it was just as Tower Hamlets was beginning to change with Canary Wharf being built. And now you go there and you can see some of the old tower blocks, but a lot of the new buildings. There were a lot more of the old tower blocks then and less of the new. And they were incredible women who wanted to have a sense of community in those areas as there was a lot of change happening around them. And they also wanted to make sure the community benefited from some of this change that was going on. And so it was, you know, there was some very strong figures there, some who went into politics in the end, actually local politics, but who wanted to try and first start by having some community projects to get women together, because they didn't often have a voice in the household, but they knew what needed to happen, as women often do in local communities. So they were just so inspiring, incredibly inspiring. And talking to them, and actually we helped fund some of their groups and work with them to sort of, you know, see how that they could expand their networks. Mm. And yeah, really inspiring. And that got me really interested in all forms of housing. So rather than just the local authority, it was really around the importance of housing and how it could really spur people on in their life and community and what's going on in the community and how communities can change through housing. So really got me much more interested in housing.
Historically, have strong women always been part of housing?
Yeah, so I once worked for a housing association called Octavia Hill Housing Association. It's now called Octavia Housing and Care. When I was there, we merged with another housing association. But every board meeting, I was the housing director there, and every board meeting we would start with a reading from Octavia Hill. And, you know, this sort of early 1900s. And they were a group of women who basically set up the housing management movement. So they would go into people's houses, they would put their white gloves on and they would run their fingers along the mantelpiece and see if there was any dust. And they would reward people for good behaviour. You would have a hot bath once a week if you, you know, behaved. And a lot of the tenants, actually, that lived in Octavia Hill were children who'd then succeeded and got tenancies, who remember the days when they were little of being part of that movement. So they expected housing management to carry on in that way, and they didn't like it when they were, you know, rowdy people or different people coming into neighbours in different ways, because they remembered it from the time of the ladies that would come round on their bicycles and would, you know, be very strict matronly in terms of their expectations. And it was just lovely hearing those stories, actually, around housing management and the start of housing management as a profession, really. Mm.
So, and before that, that would have been kind of the lowest ed would have been like slum housing or work housing and things like that.
Yeah.
And then this movement, what you just mentioned, this is what we have modern day housing associations and social housing.
That's right. So if you think of Peabody and Guinness, Octavia Hill, they were the early days, and it was really workers, you know, giving workers decent accommodation so that they could, you know, work and improve their lives. And so, you know, there was a rent that was set, and they expected to get a 5% return, but these were low rents, and it was decent housing, though. That was the thing. It was around, you know, taking people out of slums and giving them some decent housing so that they could work and so that they could, you know, sort of contribute, really.
Mm. And but that, I suppose that's a big portion of my childhood was in a place called Garden Village, which was, there was no pubs, nothing, and it was from Reckitt's, and the Reckitt's would made the village in Hull, and then people would work and go to the thingies, and then obviously got the Cadbury's.
Yeah.
So there is a link there then at the start between being independent, I suppose, isn't there, between housing, good quality housing where you can thrive and bring up your family, and then the link between industry, I suppose, and working. If you look at industry and then how it is then professionalised, and we'll move on to when you became a housing officer at Notting Hill.
That's right. Yeah.
What is a housing officer?
So it was housing management, really. So it
White
was around glove. No, changed. And the powers changed. You have courts now who determine if people have to be evicted, but in those days they could just move you on. But it was really housing management. So it was really you know, managing a patch of properties, collecting the rent, making sure the rent was paid, supporting people, you know, who needed that extra support. You know, I remember lots of people who we housed. You know, there were people who had come from hostels. You know, they'd maybe had addiction and they'd got over that addiction. You were housing them for the first time, or women who'd fled domestic violence had been in a hostel and were coming into housing. So they needed some extra support to be able to sustain their tenancy at that time. Or, you know, families or teachers or, you know, different key workers. And it was just making sure, you know, signing people up on their new tenancy, providing support, collecting the rent, and, you know, making sure that the homes were managed well, but without the white glove and the matron suit.
Mm, a little bit more, yeah, a bit more compassionate, yeah. I suppose. I'm sure there's politics, but the actual job itself, looking after people, did you thrive there? Did you enjoy it?
I loved I loved being a housing officer. I mean, it's very different now. It's much tougher, but I really enjoyed it. Just, you know, so many different people that you met with so many different stories of their lives, and it was, you know, it was a really worthwhile. It felt really worthwhile. Felt good, and really sort of enjoyable. And I suppose I never really thought about the next job. I just thought about, do I enjoy my job? But I did. When I landed in a housing association, I felt like this was home, because it was a really progressive, it was a growing sector then. You know, there was lots happening, always change, lots happening. So you felt that, I felt it was a really good fit for me in terms of it was much less bureaucratic than a local authority. You could be creative. It was growing. There were, you know, you needed solutions to problems. And yeah, it was like a great social enterprise, really. It's really how it felt.
Was the culture different from Wandsworth Council to Notting?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said, down on the culture was very different in the head office bits of Wandsworth Council. But when you went down on the estates, it was much more like a housing association in people trying to find different ways of doing things. But it was more, there were some very strong female role models and in housing associations, and there felt like more freedom, much more freedom to, and you know, local authorities had the very difficult task of housing homeless people, and they had, you know, the restrictions. Housing associations felt there was a lot more freedom around, you know, supporting local authorities, but also thinking about, you know, what other housing needs are there. Lots of supported housing, lots of older people housing. So it was, in those days, it was much more complementary to local authorities and therefore a bit more exciting.
I think you mentioned it slightly then. Was it forward thinking? Were you thinking about, you know, mental health, as in poor mental health, and how you could impact that kind of demographic?
Yeah, it was looking at all sorts of areas where, you know, there were less solutions. So we worked a lot with other organisations like Royal National Institute of the Deaf or the Blind or other charities as well. And, you know, we would have the homes, but often those organisations would provide the support. So within my patch, I had lots of other different organisations. that I worked with, and you had really good insight into those charities and what they could do as well. So yeah, it was good.
And you, after Notting Hill that first thing, you went away and you did other things with other people, policy and development and all this. You came back to Notting Hill for a second time. Why were you called God?
I was the group operations director. I think people then worked out that it was GOD. So I think I then changed it to operational group director or something like that. I just couldn't have. But they did, when I left, they did this kind of motif of the clouds and me above it. But it was brilliant. It was a brilliant job. And it was really responsible for, it's like, I suppose, chief operating officer, all the operations, all the staffing within the organisation. And it was really nice to go back because it was my first job in housing, in a housing association, as a housing officer. So it was really nice to go back as a director, you know. Having worked in a number of different organisations and worked my way up and around to be able to go back and do that. It's great.
Was you a mum at the time?
Yeah. Gosh, it's so different now. I hope for people post-pandemic, actually, I think people have realised you don't have to work silly. But I've got two children, and I had they're 20 months apart, so it was really tough. And I had one when I was a deputy housing director, and then when I was a director. And I found out I was pregnant with my second when I was going for an interview at Octavia Hill as director of housing, and I said in between the first and the second interview, I found out I was pregnant, and then they told me that I got the job, and I said, oh, I've just found out I'm pregnant. I'm really sorry. You know, you won't want me now, sort of thing. And the chief exec was a woman, and she said, you're the best person for the job. And I said, yes, but I'm pregnant. She goes, yes, I know. But, you know, you're the best person for the job. And I said, but I'll have to go off on maternity leave. And she said, yes, but you could have been here a year and then got pregnant, which was actually my plan. And, you know, to move jobs, do a year. But think, plans don't happen like that. Children come along, don't they? And so that was such a supportive thing. I was so grateful, you know, to have the opportunity to be able to become a director and do that. But it was very hard work, very hard work with two little ones. And yeah.
Did you ever feel that you shouldn't be there with small children?
Oh, yeah. We had lots of debates around you know, in the end, my husband, he gave up working for a bit to look after the kids. But, you know, we both sort of said, I'll do it. So we kind of like, you know, we did feel, I mean, it's difficult. It's really hard work when you're both working, you both got responsible jobs and you've got small children. We'd sit there and argue who had the most important evening meeting. You know, but my evening meeting is more important than your evening meeting. And it was, you know, you get to that point, you think, right, we've got to do something about this. So, yeah, I really have a lot of sympathy for people with young children and working because you just, you know, you want to be a good mother and you want to be a good employee and you want to be a good daughter and you want to be a good sister and you want to be a good friend. And it's, you've got all those competing priorities, haven't you? And you're trying to do it all. I really was one of those people that tried to do it all and just worked silly hours and hardly slept for 2 years and all of that. I thought that was the way to do it. Just work harder and then
sleep less.
I literally hardly slept at all for a few years. Yeah.
Was your confidence ever knocked?
Yeah. I mean, I think when you go on maternity leave and you come back, you always think someone else will have done a better job than you when you're off. Somebody else, well, I'm like, what if they did it better than me? Then will they want me back because they'll have seen somebody else doing a better job than me? And then also that present, it used to be much more around presenteeism. You know, am I at my desk for long enough hours? Am I showing enough commitment? And even though I was senior at that time, you know, you still never have the same level of confidence because you know, your kids come first, always your kids come first. And, you know, whatever happened, they would ring you. The school would ring the mum, even though, you know, my husband would be the one that was working nearer or not working. They'd still ring me. So you you'd be looking at the phone ringing, saying, do I answer it? But I've got to go to this meeting. And yeah, you, all those things that people have to balance.
Mm, and I've got to book doctor's appointments and this appointment, and there's a school thing going on, and it's a... It's several jobs in one, isn't it?
It is. And I always say to people, it gets better.
Gets different.
I know people say, oh, does it get better? And then people say, oh, it gets different. And I say it gets better because there's nothing as exhausting as those early days. It gets better. Yeah, of course, the problems are different, but it definitely gets better.
Yeah. Can we talk about going to Thames Valley?
Yeah. So I went from Notting Hill as operations director, I won't put the G in there, but to Thames Valley as chief executive, and I never expected to be a chief executive. I loved my job at Notting Hill. I was working with Kate Davis, who was the chief executive. She was very inspiring, and she said, "Oh, you know, you should be a chief exec." And I went, and then I went for an interview, and I didn't get the job. It was an organisation, and but I did come second, and I thought, "Oh, well, maybe I could be a chief executive." And then I waited a year for the right job to come along, and the Thames Valley job came up, and I thought, I'm going to get this, I want this, and I really went for it.
Mm. And yeah. How old were the kids then?
So the kids were sort of 10.
Okay, so still young.
Yeah, yeah.
And then how was that? What could you do there as CEO? What was the big impact you did within the organisation, but also within the sector, I suppose, as a CEO of?
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting time to join because it was 2008 and there'd been a market crash. And we had a big sales program at that time at the organisation. But you always, with every challenge, there's an opportunity. And one of the things we thought, well, what's the opportunity here? And, you know, the banks, I mean, it was a big market crash at that time and the banks were holding lots of property because there were distressed properties, so builders who'd stopped building, and so we were thinking, well, could we do this for rent, you know, for market rent? Because with social rent, you need government support, but could you, you know, there's a sector there where, you know, private rental sector where people pay huge amounts of money and they get crap service, and a lot of the homes are very poor in terms of quality. So is there an opportunity to say to the banks, well, you can get some income in if we can do it as market rent and there's a real need in this country? And all the banks said, yes, great idea, prove it, you know. We set up an organisation. It's called Fizzy Living, and it's the most successful sort of build to rent proposition that there is in the UK today. It's, you know, won loads of awards. But we decided that we would use our management expertise. We'd run key worker housing and all sorts of different housing types, and we'd use some of that model really to give a really good service, and it would be a service based model. But we wouldn't do that using borrowing against our social housing assets, because we needed to ring fence that for social housing. And if this went wrong, you don't want to have lost, you know, money on your activity. So we set it up as a purely commercial basis. And we went round to all the kind of big investors in the UK who said, we love this idea, we're thinking about it ourselves, but, you know, we could give you a few million. And we needed a big backer to be able to grow it, to show that, you know, it worked, and somebody who would stay with us. So we went outside the UK and in Canada, in America, in the Middle East, and the institutions and the pension funds, etc., invest in this a lot because they see they've seen it grow, and they saw the build to rent sector in the States grow, and they'd really never understood why in the UK, in London as a global city, you didn't have a rental, professional rental proposition. So they were like baffled, really. But there was nobody to manage it, because the reason institutions find it difficult to invest often is because they don't want the reputational damage. They need a professional manager. Mm. So we came up with a solution, and the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority backed it, and we set up Fizzy Living, and it's grown. It's really successful. And that's done without any access to our social housing activity. And I think what I was really proud of is around using the skills of a housing association in today's market failure. So yesterday's market failure, when housing associations were set up, is, you know, really poor conditions, and, you know, Notting Hill and Brixton and these places were just, you know, full of really poor private rental accommodation that big families were living in, and housing associations went in there. That started the regeneration of those areas. They've completely changed now. And this was a modern day market failure. The private rental sector doesn't work for a lot of people because it doesn't give them, people have to move around all the time. There's short-term tenancies. There's no good repair service. Landlords that are there, they're faceless. They may be abroad, and you know, there's no face for the landlord in the UK. So, you know, this was about a professionalised market rent proposition that got backing. And now, you know, having proved it, there are loads of investors in the market. It's one of the biggest growing sectors. You've got them all over Manchester and Leeds and London and Bristol. You've got professional build to rent, market rent blocks all over the place, and investors are pouring in to do it.
We, as a society, I always think we look down at social housing and it's like the inferior product. But what you've just said in that, you know, that a few paragraphs there, it leads the way and it rejuvenates and revitalises areas. A lot of it stems from that social housing or the housing association or the trust, whatever, being more flexible and thinking outside the box to solve a problem. Quite entrepreneurial, really. You know, there's a problem, how do we solve it? And off the back of that, everything else gets better. Almost you could say that an integral part of a community is social housing, really.
Yeah, I mean there's been a lot of changes. You know, we've seen a reduction in social housing in this country, and therefore it's much harder to get it. And therefore, you know, it's about vulnerability points. You know, the more vulnerable you are or need points, and the more, you know, liable you are or able to access it. But it wasn't like that. You know, a lot more people accessed social housing before. But it can be a real catalyst for change. And I really see that in my organisation. You know, we kind of said at home and the opportunity to live well. And if you have a home, you have that opportunity. And from that, you can do so much more.
You moved from Thames Valley to Metropolitan a year after as CEO, and then those two organisations merged. What was there two CEOs and there was only one job? That's how it worked.
No, so how it worked is I moved to Metropolitan, you know, a bigger organisation, different organisation. And then the board started talking. They got on really well and, you know, could see a great future for a new organisation. And so it was pretty quick, actually, the merger that happened a year later.
By you moving, it kind of brought things,
yeah, the
conversation
the chairs
together.
The chairs started talking, and then they started. I had nothing to do with this. They started talking, and then they said, well, there's an opportunity here, maybe, because both organisations had tried to merge previously and failed, but there was real synergy in their vision, really, for the new organisation. So that's how it came about.
Mm. So we got Metropolitan Thames Valley Housing. That's what it's called now. What is it? What do you do?
So we've got around 60,000 homes, and we work into the Midlands, into sort of Derby, Nottingham, we're in Cambridge, we're in London and the surrounding areas. And we do a whole host of things. So we do commercial housing. So we build homes for market rent and market sale. We do social housing. That's our core. But we do quite a lot of supported housing as well, and care as well. And we have a migration foundation, which is supporting refugees. We also do a lot of shared ownership, so people get their first step on the housing ladder. We do key worker housing, so we work with 8 different NHS trusts to build homes for workers for those NHS hospitals. So all sorts of different housing solutions, right from the very social to the very commercial.
Mm. Do you, as a CEO, do you ever get lost in the business, or are you still connected to the resident, the individual who's living?
I mean, obviously, they're big organisations, big businesses. But to me, whenever I feel like I'm spending all my time in meetings, I get myself out there and meet the residents or go to one of our support schemes. And it just completely revitalises me to remind me of what we're here for and what we do. And it's just so important to make sure you still go out there and, you know, talk to people who are working on the front line, but also the residents. And, you know, I think I said at the beginning that I loved being a housing officer because you just met so many different people and their lives. And that's what's so rich still is about the people. That's what still motivates me.
2 years ago, there was a fire in Sutton. And it was pretty bad.
It was horrendous. It was, one of the most difficult things to have seen in my career. And, you know, the residents, there was one thing that was amazing, the way the community got together to support the residents who were impacted by the fire. It was incredible. You know, people were there, they were giving, because the building burnt down and it burnt down very quickly and it was horrendous and people got out of that building alive. But, you know, obviously they were fleeing in their pyjamas in the night. And, you know, the building burnt down and, you know, it's being rebuilt now. We're rebuilding it. So that's how devastating it was. It wasn't like a little bit. It was a whole thing that burned down. Going there, you know, in the early hours of the morning, within that morning, it's part of a bigger estate with private homes and social homes on it. But there's like an estate office down there. And it was full with people bringing clothes, bringing, provisions down there. And a lot had been learnt from Grenfell, you know, in terms of the Red Cross about, you know, people didn't have passports, they didn't have identity. Mm-hmm. All of that, I think, had been learnt from Grenfell about how to act quickly. And, you know, we were helping people into temporary accommodation, you know, from hotels, quickly getting people into a rental home, private rental home, because obviously the building has to be rebuilt. They're not going to be moving any time quickly. So people need to feel like they've got a home again. But, you know, it was absolutely devastating for individuals. It changed their lives. I remember, you know, a woman saying, my child has nothing left from their childhood. You know, there's nothing. There's no one thing that they've got that they can take with them of their childhood. Loads of individual stories of people who were impacted by that fire.
And was it cladding?
The cladding was fine. You know, the cladding met all the requirements. It was the lack of fire breaks behind the cladding. So it went up like a sort of chimney behind the cladding and then through its timber frame. And it, obviously, you need to have the appropriate fire breaks in place. So it wasn't the actual cladding, it was what was behind the cladding. And not behind the cladding.
I don't know if you know the technicalities, but did the cladding prevent early signs or did it just...
It was like a chimney.
So it was sucking the air in and moving it very, very quickly in between the floors.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was you there when it was on fire?
I was down there. I mean, I got the call in the night, so I was down there in the early hours of the morning. Yeah, it was still, you know.
Did you take it personal? Because who's responsible for this? You know, how can you predict that as a CEO?
I mean, you know, it is one of the most, you question yourself, everything around, you know, we bought that in good faith from the developer. You know, that building we bought in good faith in the same way it was shared owners. They bought it in good faith. They bought their shares in good faith. There's a whole estate there, all built in the same materials. it's incredibly personally impactful. You question everything. Could we have done anything differently? Did we, you know, we did our risk assessments, etc. But it's very personally, it's very impactful. You know, you just feel like you've let people down.
Mm. The one place you're not letting people down, you're not, this is a strange situation which you're dealing with, is you said earlier on, the Migration Foundation.
Yeah.
Tell me about the full thing. And
so one of our previous mergers from the old sort of, you know, from earlier days was a housing association called Refugee Housing that merged in with Metropolitan in those days. And there was a ring, as part of the merger, there was a ring-fenced sum of money, which is for refugees. And the foundation, the Migration Foundation, utilises that money really to help destitute migrants. And we do some we support a lot of projects. And one of the biggest areas that people need support is legal help, really, and legal advice. And we support lots of other organisations. But also what we've done is, rather than fulfilling any contracts, government contracts, is actually what do people really need and looking at it from basics and what can we provide. So in Derby, we had a property which wasn't really being utilised for anything. We were going to hand it back to the local authority. The local authority said they did want it. So we used the money from our foundation to do it up and provide support to people that nobody else is supporting. And, you know, people come off the streets or they come through different organisations and we give them a home and until their decision is made around whether they can stay. We support them with skills, we support them in employment. We get great support from local supermarkets who provide food because obviously these people have got no access to funds. Mm. And, you know, we give them some vouchers, some, you know, to resources really for to enable them to live. And, you know, if people get a negative determination and have to return, we give them that emotional support in terms of if they're having to return. But most people do manage to stay, do great jobs and are completely committed to the community. What is so great to see is if refugees get support, they're so determined to give back to other people. I saw that with my dad. You know, I was talking earlier, he really helped other Indians settle in this country and get, you know, work and then everybody feels really grateful that they've been accepted by another country. And a lot of the people who are working with us in our foundation have been refugees and they're giving back and supporting other refugees. And you know, we need people, we need skills, we need, gosh, we've got so many shortages, haven't we, here? You give people some hope and some skills and they can do amazing things. And that's what our foundation does. It gives people hope, it gives them skills, it gives them some resources. They get settled, they give back and people move on and get on with their lives and new lots come in. And so it's a wonderful resource, real commitment as well from us to keep that going.
Our country is... our country's values, the way we've built over centuries is based on migration, including refugees and coming in and working together to build something better. When we look at working together, the G15, what is that?
So it's actually 12 of London's largest housing associations. It used to be 15, numbers changed, but we've kept the brand. But, you know, we house 1 in 10 Londoners and build a quarter of London's homes. So we're big developers, we're big managers, and we're big in the community in London. I think people don't kind of, that figure is quite impactful, really. We house 1 in 10 Londoners is amazing, really, because that's the impact of housing associations. And so really we work together on, you know, some key messaging around, you know, what we want to portray to government around what the needs are, sharing information, you know, sharing a problem, and yeah, just sort of working together as large organisations for London.
Because you chair that.
I chair that group. Yeah.
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 And then how? So we've looked at, I'd like to look at four things, and obviously we're not going into great depth of them, but how how are the larger organisations bouncing back from the pandemic?
I think we learnt a lot through the pandemic around our customers. So there was a huge amount of motivation to connect with the communities and our residents during that time and support them. And so from that, you really reconnect in the difficulties people are having around food poverty, fuel poverty, you know, a lot of poverty in terms of a lot of our residents and what they're going through, and post-pandemic in terms of work, how they were managing. You know, they were doing a lot of the jobs. They were the bus drivers, they were the supermarket workers, they were the health workers working through that time. But also they were, you know, our residents were not in spacious houses saving lots of money as other people were. They were struggling through that time. So, you know, we spent a lot of time through the pandemic really, really focusing on our residents and what support we can give them. And that's a real priority for us as well going forwards, is around, you know, as we come out of this, and we're early days about knowing what is happening, but how can we continue to support people through these next few years? That's a real big priority for us.
And the well-being support beyond this as well.
Yeah.
And understanding how this is going to affect children in 5 years or a family in 10 years.
Yeah, I was with yesterday, we had a board meeting. We had a number of residents come and talk to us. And, you know, one of the organisations we work with called Tutors United, and we pay them really to help give extra tuition to kids. And they were doing this all through the pandemic, and, you know, supporting kids one-to-one. And the stories around those kids around lack of access to computers, you know, there's a lot of them having to share a laptop or a computer. So we were giving them out. So trying to help them with their well-being, with their mental health through this time, and connecting. It's a really great project. It's students at university who volunteer and work with the kids. And so they're young, so they're closer in age to the kids, and they give them support, and they love it. So it gives the university students skills, and it gives the young people skills. I mean, this is the great thing about our country, isn't there? There's so many great charities and work that people can do and support, and really helping the parents. A lot, you know, one parent was saying, I've got dyslexia. I didn't know how to help my kids through this time. So having kind of organisations like that was supporting those parents and others, there was nowhere for them to go. You know, they couldn't leave their home and they were completely overcrowded. You know, lots of those stories. So that is going to have longer lasting impact on people, and it's really important to understand that, and working with other organisations, much better able to support than we can, but supporting them and connecting them with our residents and working with them is really important.
I want to ask you a question that you might not be comfortable answering, but you need to answer this one. You know, look at your background, where your parents came from, where you came from, the challenges you've faced throughout your life so far, and the successes you've achieved both individually and as a team. What are you most proud of, what you've done within the sector?
I think one of the things is really about making sure we think of diversity and don't have groupthink. I don't really know how else to put it, but it's, you know, I think a lot of the time you don't solve a problem by all thinking the same. You've got to have different life experiences. And I think what I'm really passionate about is people, a lot of people who work for us, you know, have grown up in social housing or have come from the communities that we house. And a lot of the time those skills aren't recognised as a skill, but it is. It's a really, really important skill that we have people who've got very different backgrounds, and they're not all professional. You know, they've come from those different backgrounds, and that we listen to people and we create organisations that are diverse. And so for me, it's been about working with different people through my career and encouraging them to make that next move, encouraging them, who people who maybe don't have the confidence that they can do it and they should be able to think about that next step. And you know, working with our board to be more diverse and bring more diversity into the industry, that's been really important to me, because I do think it's about better services, and it's not about just those individuals, it's about what they can do. And I think social class is probably one we haven't cracked yet. I still think there's a big thing around social class and in organisations.
Geeta, thank you so much, and we will leave it there.